Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Jill Wine Banks. Let's get on to the show where we'll discuss, as usual, all of Trump's legal problems, but we're going to add to that Hunter Biden's legal case and Fearless, a VC firm, venture capital firm, that had a foundation that was giving grants to Black women entrepreneurs and has now been stopped. So we'll get on to that. But before we do, I want to just reminisce about our day in Boston. We happened to be there on the day the verdict came down. Our show started almost immediately after the verdict. The audience was wild with enthusiasm. So let's just talk about how each of us felt in that moment and with the enthusiasm of the audience. Joyce, why don't you start?
Yeah, I mean, it was just so much fun being in Boston. And it was super special for me because my college house came down. Not just my roommate, who I was amazingly happy came down from Maine for it, but it was just so much fun to see everybody and the general, you know, just the excitement from the minute that the verdict came down was just nuts. I will tell a small story out of school. This will probably get me in trouble, but my husband and I were in the lobby of our hotel, and my dear friend Katie Fang, who's a host on MSNBC, texted me just one word, verdict. And I was like, ha, 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 Katie, you are so funny. And she texted me back, verdict. So it was an experience, wasn't it, y'all?
Barb?
Yeah, you know, we were leaving the hotel to head over to the venue, the Schubert Theater, which was beautiful. 1,500 seats, sold out, beautiful auditorium. And we saw that there was a verdict and it was time to go. So we got in a car, went a short distance to the theater. And then, you know, we know it takes a little bit of time usually between the time a jury sends out a note saying they have a verdict and they get everybody assembled in court and the judge is on the bench so that they can take the verdict. So we thought, well, we've got enough time just to get there and then we'll watch it and pay attention to it. But as we're walking into the theater, we hear this roar from all over Boston. I thought, oh, that must be the verdict. I assume that means guilty. And sure enough, it was. And then we we were in a little backstage area with, I think somebody had an iPad up and we were watching, you know, them count the verdicts, count one guilty, count two guilty, count three, up to 34 for 34.
34 guilty so, counts.
and you know, it's not that I take glee in the conviction of Donald Trump as a, you know, political vengeance moment. It is that the rule of law was upheld against even the, one of the most powerful people in the United States.
Yes.
In a court of law, 12 people, strangers to each other, returned that verdict. And after we paid such close attention to it and saw that the evidence was very strong, it was just really reaffirming to see the system work like that. So it was a really joyful moment. And as a result, the show was very joyful as well.
Yeah, it was so great to be in my home away from home on such a momentous day, not just because of my friends and family who are in attendance, but also because I would have not wanted the day for that verdict to come down and be with anybody else than my sisters-in-law. So it really was perfect.
It was a perfect day to be with all of you. I cannot think of anyone I would have rather shared that particular historic moment with than the three of you. Plus, I also had the gift of my mentee who is a chaplain at Tufts Hospital and also at the Arlington Church. And it was just so special to be there. And the audience gave us so much energy. I hope we can repeat that many times over. It was fabulous. But now let's get on to the show.
Well, we are back talking about Donald Trump again this week. That's no surprise, but you know, if you're like me, listeners, you may have a little bit of Trump fatigue. I mean, it almost feels like a guilty verdict on 34 felony counts should be enough to end a political career. It probably would have been enough to end any political career, but not so for Donald Trump, who has three other criminal cases pending. We'll talk about those today and also try to make sense of why this is still a thing. So Jill, let's start back in Manhattan, where Trump's first steps after being convicted on 34 felony counts was to ask the judge to end the gag order that keeps him from talking about court and prosecution personnel, about witnesses and jurors. And Trump has made a pretty interesting argument in the letter brief he submitted to the court. He says, look, I'm a candidate for president, and this violates my First Amendment rights. I'm curious to know what you think about that, right? It's not an entirely unreasonable argument, given the deference that our system gives to the First Amendment in a political context. Can you talk about what the district attorney has asked for in response and what you think the correct resolution of this matter is?
So let me start by saying I agree with you that unlike most of his motions, this one actually is not ridiculous. It has some semblance of sanity to it. He's saying, hey, the trial's over, so I should be free to say anything I want, especially because I'm running for office. And for me, the decision is a balancing act. In First Amendment cases, we always have to balance the First Amendment and, in this case, court security. The DA has asked in a very reasonable fashion that the gag order be extended at least until July 11th when Donald Trump is sentenced. And he's said that it's because the court has an obligation to protect the integrity of the all the proceedings. And that seems very fair to me. It seems the fair administration of justice is required to not have the defendant saying things against the system of justice. And so there are still, you know, some post-trial motions in the sentencing. And I think the harm to the integrity of the case itself requires a balancing of the First Amendment to say, no, he can't. Now, the defense is also arguing that Trump should be free because Biden commented on the verdict. And so he should be able to comment back. And that, again, is not an unreasonable thing to say. He has gotten away with calling two of the key witnesses sleazebags and has not been held in contempt for that as a violation of the gag order. So In the meantime, the DA has asked that they delay any decision on this until it can be fully briefed, which would mean the gag order would stay in place for at least a few more weeks until it's briefed and argued.
Yeah, I love that the DA is actually the one pushing for delay here, right? We want this on the same briefing schedule as all of Trump's other motions, not something that gets decided out of order, which is a nice little touch. I wonder if we won't hear when the DA writes its brief, if they might not focus pretty heavily on these post-trial efforts to dox jurors and witnesses. You know, Donald Trump is not linked to that, so I don't want to overstate that, right? But it does seem like every time he talks about it, there is more risk. And I actually think that that's tough since he's not responsible for it. He's not, at least at this stage, overtly promoting it. I'll be interested to see how the court balances the rights. I noticed that the district attorney said in their letter that they would take on in their briefing whether the court could narrow the gag order in any way. So it sounds to me like they're sensitive to those issues too. Do you think, Jill, or is it something else?
No, I think you're absolutely right on that, and that this is a reasonable argument and should be fully briefed and argued before the judge and a balance achieved, which I think this judge will do. He's shown that he is well-balanced in his rulings, and I think this will be no exception.
So, Barb, in Mar-a-Lago, Judge Cannon, who just recently, by the way, announced, I can't set a trial date in the classified documents case because I have this terrible back order of pending motions. And so what does she turn around and do? She's completely blown off her previous schedule for hearing motions that have been stacked up in that queue. And instead, she's going to hold an unusual hearing on an argument by Trump and one of his co-defendants that says that the appointment of the special counsel was unconstitutional. So the entire case needs to be dismissed. Can you talk about that hearing and what's so unusual about it and just what you make about the way she's conducting this?
Oh, where do I begin, Joyce? Yeah. so much to unpack there. You know, I like to presume good faith by judges, even when they do things that I might disagree with. But this is so far out beyond the norm. Let me start with this. When a judge adjourns a trial date, and that happens a lot, things happen in litigation that is unexpected and that causes dates to get set and reset as motions get filed and other things happen. But what judges almost always do is that they set a new date. That's because there's a speedy trial clock that is ticking in cases. There's a right of the defendant to have a trial within 70 days and the right of the public to have a speedy trial. That clock gets tolled for various reasons, but there is a strong public policy interest in keeping that case moving. And so what almost always happens is even if there is a delay, I think the original trial date in this case was something like May 20th or May 25th, you set a new date. You say, okay, we need to adjourn this because we have to deal with these motions. So let's set a new date that's 30 days out or 60 days out or 90 days out. It's usually in 1 month increments like that, you know. And that way you've got a control date out there so that things just don't languish. And so the very first critique I have is that she has adjourned this trial date without a date certain, which I think is a breach of her responsibilities as a judge. A judge is supposed to set a trial date. So that's the first thing. The second is she is entertaining this motion and taking seriously this challenge to the special counsel statute. This is an issue that has been litigated a number of times. Hunter Biden raised this. It's been raised in some of the Trump cases elsewhere. And it's going nowhere. There is Supreme Court precedent in a case called Morrison versus Olson upholding a prior iteration of what was called the independent counsel statute that had less control and oversight by the Department of Justice than this one does. And that one was upheld. This one was created to respond to a dissent in that case by Justice Scalia that it was creating some sort of fourth branch of government that was potentially unconstitutional, which is why they moved the special counsel under the authority of the attorney general so that ultimately the attorney general has to approve it. So I think there's just the legal arguments here are so weak. So she's taking it seriously instead of summarily dismissing it. So that's my second gripe about this. But the third gripe is that she is accepting amicus briefs on this, which is people who are not the parties themselves, but other people who claim to have an interest in this case. You know, the Supreme Court does this from time to time, actually most of the time. If there's a gun case, they'll hear from gun owners, even if they're not parties to the case. They'll hear from gun manufacturers. They'll hear from sportsmen or associations, right, to understand the impact of a decision on these various groups. It is allowed in the district court, which is where we are, but really very, very rare. And that's because at the district court level, most of the time, the court is dealing with factual issues as opposed to rewriting the law, which is something the Supreme Court has the authority to do. And not only is she going to hold a hearing on this, which is my third gripe, but I've got a fourth one, which is she's going to allow all these amici, these friends of the court, to not just submit briefs, but to argue and participate in oral argument. And I worry, Joyce, that the reason that she is doing this is, number one, to stall, because this will certainly slow things down. But by inviting some of these amici, one of which that opposes the special counsel includes former attorneys general Michael Mukasey and Ed Meese, who are going to argue that the special counsel statute is unconstitutional, because then she has the cover. If she does decide to dismiss the case on this basis, she can say, well, look, I've got these two former attorneys general who said this is unconstitutional. So yeah, it's not just me. I'm going to grant the motion. And then even if she's wrong, it'll have to be appealed and see it in about a year before this case comes to trial. So
I mean,
that's
not
my
to put
fifth
a,
beef.
Not to put a finer point on this, but as women, this is crazy. In a trial, in a criminal trial, the idea that you would have amici submitting briefs and arguing at a motion, that's insane. That's,
I mean,
absolutely crazy.
Can we
crazy.
Just say amici sounds so formal and legalistic? Who these people really are is non-parties who
yes.
have no interest in the outcome of this case, right? It's like, go out on the street corner and say, hey, y'all come on in and tell me what you
trial?
Think. Yeah. I mean,
like, it's
nuts.
Crazy.
And you know, Barb, I think you make a really good point. I was going to ask, by the way, are you done? Do you have only four objections?
If five. You have,
I counted five.
I counted five. I'll stop there.
I
mean,
I was going to say. I have another one, Joyce.
Okay,
Joyce,
but hang on one sec. Hang on one sec, Joyce. Because I was going to say, you know, in a perfect world, Barb, I would hope that the 11th Circuit, if she rules to dismiss the case, would act quickly. They've done it before. But I think you're right. Even if they move quickly, there still has to be a briefing schedule. I mean, we're talking weeks, even if they're very efficient. And the real risk here is that it could be another year, which is nuts. Okay, Jill, add to the list, please.
Okay, so I'm adding to the list two things. One is, of course, friends of the court totally blow away standing. They don't have standing. They don't have anything at stake in this hearing. So that makes it even worse. But also, she's saying, I can't set a trial date, going to Barbara's earlier point about how ridiculous not to set a new date, because she said we have this backlog of motions. And the reason we have that backlog is because she's indecisive and hasn't taken action. It's her fault
right.
that we have this.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked about tautology in another connection. This is a tautology. I can't do it because I can't do it because we have a backlog because I created the backlog.
Yeah. And I mean, to that point, did you guys see CNN had a story that ran this morning, Friday morning, talking about Judge
yes.
Cannon and coming
yes.
up with their theory of what was wrong with her. What did y'all make of that story? Barb, it sounds like you read it.
I read it. You know, yeah. I mean, it's always a little bit speculative. I mean, they point to, I mean, I think the article is actually pretty fair. It doesn't say that, like, you know, she's out to rule in favor of Donald Trump or, you know, she's politically in the bag or anything like that. But they try to kind of psychoanalyze her, which I always think is a little bit dangerous. But they point to a couple of things. One is that she worked in a U.S. attorney's office in Miami, which is a very good U.S. attorney's office, but she was in the appellate division, and that she tends to look at things in a much more formal, academic, legal way, as opposed to kind of the real world, practical, seat of the pants kind of perspective an effective trial judge has, that maybe she would be better suited to the appellate bench. They also talk about how she's very isolated there in Fort Pierce. She's the only judge. And so she doesn't have surrounding her the colleagues that other judges have, where you can bounce things off people. You know, you can say, hey, I got this issue. What do you think? And, you know, who can kind of help provide some, you know, common sense and experience. So I thought that was interesting. But I'll tell you my personal theory that more and more I have, and this goes for people, whether they are you know, conservative, progressive, anywhere in between. I think we are all influenced by the people we spend time with. And so if she is spending time with people in the Federalist Society or watching Fox News, she is probably hearing and being influenced, even if she's acting in good faith, by all of this, you know, nonsense that gets spewed. I'm sure people who spend their time in progressive circles are influenced by what they hear. I think that is the reason that people like Harlan Crow want to pal around with people like Clarence Thomas. It is, if I have your ear, I can constantly tell you, you know, how the system ought to work. And that has some influence on people. People are, you know, chameleons to some extent. We become, you know, the people that we spend time with. So I think that's my personal tea leaf read psychoanalysis, but I don't know what others thought about the article.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was so much a psychoanalysis, honestly. I think what it does is it tracks with other things that we've seen, including a piece that we talked about before by David Latt. It points to three things. She's relatively new at these jobs. She doesn't have a ton of experience in trial work in any way, trying or judging. And so this is new, and this was a big case. She focuses on form over substance, meaning that she can get really distracted by the technicalities of rules and people not following the technicalities of the rules, that she misses the forest of the case for the trees. And another is, because of that, things can tend to back up, get backlogged. And when that happens, she gets overwhelmed and is doing basically what we see in this case, saying, oh, there's so many motions stacked up, we need to put everything on pause. And things that should take weeks take months or longer. And that this is a consistent pattern that has been seen by the judges and the attorneys who have argued before her or with her, worked with her. And we're seeing that play out here. I personally don't know if her ideology has anything to do with it. I think she's in over her head. She's sort of digging into that as opposed to reacting to it and trying to fix it. And the CNN piece just sort of backs up that there is a history of her doing that.
I thought the piece was really interesting. And I agree with Barb that it was fair. It didn't go one way or the other. It pointed out real examples of things that it concluded, so that it backed up its conclusions with examples of how she behaved. And I thought that was important. But it also talked about how easily diverted she was by anything that caught her eye. You know, oh, this is an interesting side issue. It has nothing to do with the trial. And I would say that, you know, even this latest thing with whether the special counsel law is constitutional is one of those things that's really a diversion from the trial itself. And I thought that was an interesting perspective on her background as an appellate lawyer. She didn't try cases. She hasn't had many trials, criminal trials anyway, as a judge. And so I think that's why she's gone off. And I also think Barb was correct when she said she's alone there. She is the only judge in Fort Pierce. And she doesn't have colleagues that she has lunch with who could help her get adjusted. And there was a senior judge who took what would have been her first criminal trial and said, hey, you know, I'll help you out here and I'll take this. He now says it was because he likes volunteering to keep on trying cases. But, you know, we hope she's learned from this. But so far, I haven't seen that happen. Her learning curve is pretty slow.
Yeah, I was really taken by the note that she had only been, it didn't even say she was the lead counsel. She'd been on the trial team in, I think, four cases in her years in the U.S. Attorney's Office. But, you know, something that I know about federal district judges, and especially new ones, is that, and even more so when they're in a smaller or a more isolated courthouse, they do reach out to their colleagues. They don't even have to reach out, right? Because their colleagues all reach out to them and say, what can we do to help? And judges have desk books that explain procedure. They go off to the Federal Judicial Center in Washington where they get training. I mean, there are all of these opportunities. And so this article, which I too thought was really good, it's based largely on comments from litigants who appear in front of the judge. And we all know we've been tracking this with the Supreme Court, right? Lawyers who appear in front of judges ain't going to bring their worst criticism. So, I think it's just a messy situation.
Can I just add one more quick point? Because I know we're going over, but That's why I found it very distressing that the judiciary chose to sort of shut down the complaints that were being filed against her as opposed to actually listen. Listen, I understand if there are people without business before the court, you can weed those out. But when judges and litigants and attorneys who argue before this court are making complaints, the answer is not to say, oh, there are too many, so we're going to shut it down. The answer is to say, let's take a look at why these people are making these complaints and see what can be done about it. This is why we have this complaint system.
I had exactly the same reaction, Kim. That was an order signed by the Chief Judge of the 11th Circuit, William Pryor. And what he said was, we've heard it all. These are all coming in from the community. We've heard enough, you know. And he sort of dressed it up a little bit, and the law does not require us to consider these repetitive things. I had very much your reaction. So, Kim, let's talk about Georgia. Speaking of complaints about, in this case, not a judge, but a prosecutor. More delay in Georgia. Entirely expected, right? This is about the scheduling of the continuing effort to keep Fannie Willis off of the case. And the court also entered a stay of proceedings in the trial court, at least as against the parties who are pursuing the Fannie Willis complaint. And I sort of wonder, you know, are the attacks on Fannie Willis ever going to end? We talked about this a little bit last week in Boston, but this appeal, this effort to keep her off the case is just a marker for a lot of the other issues that we see in the legal system and in society. How do you think we ought to be approaching this as we think about what's going on in Georgia?
Oh, I think it's just like that. Listen, I think the two facts to keep first and foremost are that she was not removed from the case and she was not shown to have violated any rule. There is not a rule against any fraternization with anybody in or connected to the office. Yes, she had previously promised that she wouldn't do that, and then she did. But that's not a violation of the rule. That is not an appealable, that is not any sort of reversible error. And as we mentioned ad nauseum when the claim was initially made, if there was any conflict, it was on the same side as the V, as Barb said. It did not have anything to do with an impetus to prosecute the defendants in this case. So we're already starting off on, you know, with a disingenuous challenge. But of course, now it needs to be dragged out. And the courts in Georgia are going to allow this to continue to go on. It means it's going to be more character assassinations of Fannie Willis, because she's one of the people who has tried harder, along with the likes of Letitia James and Alvin Bragg, to protect democracy, and Jack Smith, to protect democracy against Donald Trump and his acolytes who seek to destroy it. And so you will see everybody on Donald Trump's side do use every lever in the judiciary, while at the same time disparaging and trying to take a sledgehammer to the judiciary to try to get out of this. And that's all this is.
Well, that's not particularly encouraging, and it means, not that we expected this anyhow, but we simply won't see the Georgia case go to trial anytime soon.
And again, I don't think we were going to see it go to trial before, but the way that this is going down is Donald Trump's doing, not Fannie Willis's.
Bingo. Okay, well, let's talk about Wisconsin, where there was a new development this week. Prosecutors in Wisconsin indicted a fake electors case, sort of out of the blue. Jill, what are the charges and who are the defendants?
Well, it's not exactly out of the blue, because Wisconsin is the fifth state to indict the fake electors. And this one is against three people. One is, and two at least, are names that everyone's going to know, Cheeseboro and Michael Roman. Roman related back to the Fannie Willis case, because it was his lawyer that filed the complaint based on the affair between Willis and Wade. So those are pretty much known names. And the third was a former judge who had been working for the Trump campaign, Judge Tropas. And he became famous because his email exchanges became public that were really very provocative about making sure that the fake elector stuff got to Congress so that it could be used to stop the certification of the vote. And it's clear that in this case, the indictment is for one count felony against each of them, a felony that carries in Wisconsin a $10,000 fine and a six-year sentence. And it also, although Donald Trump is not named in this particular indictment, the Attorney General of Wisconsin said it's still under investigation, which means that there could be more defendants added. And so they're charged with drafting and circulating this certification signed by fake electors. And it didn't have the disclaimer that says to be used only if there is an issue at the time of the certification, which of course there wasn't. So it's an interesting case, and it's going to go forward along with the other states that have also indicted for the fake electors. And I would point out that Roman has pleaded guilty in the Georgia case for similar conduct. So maybe he's cooperating in Georgia. I mean, sorry, he pled guilty in Georgia. So, you know, it's surprising that he's now indicted and isn't cooperating in Wisconsin, but there you have it.
I mean, it is really intriguing. And Kim, why do you think it happened now, right? We're 4 years out. So is there something that happened that led to this timing?
Girl, search me. I don't know. I don't know why any of these things have taken this long. I mean, if people who actually stormed the Capitol have served, you know, some of them have served their jail time already and gotten out, then I don't know why this is taking so long.
Hey, Barb, do you have any views on that? And also, do you think that there's a potential case, you know, since this involves players at the national level, could this maybe sort of break the logjam and develop more cooperators and perhaps ultimately give Jack Smith a little bit of aid if his January 6th case ever makes it across the finish line to trial?
Yes. I've always thought that when you are negotiating with another party, the more variables in play, the more opportunities there are to craft and be creative in structuring plea deals. And so when people are charged in more than one venue, it creates some pressure on them, I think, to try to work out some sort of global resolution to say, all right, if I plead guilty and I tell everybody the truth, what's the best you can do for me? Oftentimes, that's the best solution a lawyer can get for their client. But it usually requires being truthful in every venue. Everybody's going to get a chance to, you know, use you as a witness, to interview you, to find out everything you know, and to provide a download. So I think if you're a prosecutor in any one of these other states and you see these people like, you know, Kenneth Chesbrough and others being charged, it's good news. It's all right, there's another opportunity for me to talk with the prosecutors in that jurisdiction to see if we can work out some resolution where this person can become a cooperator. Because as you know, Joyce, and as everybody who's just watched the Donald Trump trial with Michael Cohen, there is no, what is the word? No loyalty among thieves. You know, people have baggage, they have credibility issues, but oftentimes they're the ones who actually know what happened because they were in the rooms when these things were being discussed. They were on the inside. And so if you can corroborate their testimony with the testimony of other witnesses or documents and emails and financial records and other kinds of things, they can be bolstered and can be credible. And so I do think that this is a good opportunity for potential resolution of some of those other cases.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, kudos to our friend, our former colleague, Barb Mary McCord, who used to run the National Security Division at DOJ. She's now at ACAPI at Georgetown Law School. And she was involved in litigation that exposed some of the emails back and forth between these guys and puts them right in the middle of the effort to get these fake ballots in Mike Pence's hands on January 6th. So I'm optimistic, too, about what might possibly happen here. Those emails, by the way, are worth taking a look at. And I had linked to some of them in my Substack this week. So I will pop that into the show notes in case anyone wants to take a look and learn a little bit more about who Jim Tropas, this retired judge, is.
This week, the federal gun possession trial of Hunter Biden got underway. Prosecutors put on their case, tasked with proving that the president's son intentionally made a false statement when purchasing a firearm as a drug user. Biden has pleaded not guilty. Jill, I want to get your impression of the case that the government put on this week. Remember that initially, prosecutors had agreed to a plea deal with Hunter Biden's attorneys, and that all fell apart. And I wondered if part of that reason was because it may not be as easy to prove A, the intentionality with the making of the false report, and also proving that he was in possession of or using narcotics at the time that he made that statement. What did you think? How do you think the prosecution did?
So I before I answer that, I just want to also point out that it's really unusual that this case is being prosecuted at all. And I truly believe that if the defendant's name wasn't Biden, he would not be prosecuted, because if we look at the history of this kind of prosecutions, it involves people who have committed crimes with the gun, not just that they possessed it, but that they committed a crime with it. And so this is an unusual case. In terms of the things you've raised, which are intentionality and proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he had been using drugs at the time he said he wasn't, I don't think they have proved that. I think that the reasonable doubt definitely exists about, one, whether he was telling the truth because he believed he was not a drug addicted person at the time he signed that form. And I also think that the defense, which started, and by the way, you said it, the case had started, but it is also almost wrapped up. The only question left is whether Hunter Biden will testify. And as we've pointed out numerous times about Donald Trump, it's unusual for a defendant to testify, but the defense has until Monday to decide that. They have said they will not call any other witnesses. But that means that this weekend, the jury is sitting with the testimony of Hunter Biden's daughter, which was a pretty emotional testimony about her seeing her father at the time at issue and not thinking that he was involved with drugs at the time. And no one has testified that they saw him using drugs or anything even close to that. So I think they have failed in a key element, which is they have to prove he was using drugs at the time he said he wasn't. And I don't think they've met that burden.
Yeah, Barb, as Jill pointed out, so much of the testimony, both from the prosecution and the defense, have involved something that I know a lot of people have dealt with, which is just the devastation that drug addiction means not only for the person with the addiction, but for their loved ones. And from Jill Biden showing up, actually flying back from the Normandy ceremonies in France and to be there and then flying back to France to Hunter Biden's daughter who testified on Friday and other family members. As a prosecutor, this is a sensitive thing to handle, right? How did you handle very sensitive and emotional testimony when it was crucial to a criminal case?
Yes, I think prosecutors have to be very careful, and we always were. We would discuss these issues to make it clear that you don't want the jury to convict a defendant because of human failure or, you know, human fragility. So, you know, sometimes we'd have a case where there was an extramarital affair that was involved in the case. And I always advised our lawyers, and I always tried to do this myself, sometimes to just steer clear of that stuff, because you don't want the jury to think, you're judging him because of this moral failure, when in fact it is because of a violation of a federal statute. And you really have to focus on the elements of that statute. You know, here it is, lying on a form about whether he was addicted or using drugs at the time he purchased this gun and then possessing this gun as a person who was using illegal drugs. But it is so intertwined in this case with addiction that I don't think you can in any way tell this story without focusing on the addiction. But I thought the prosecution did something effective in opening statement, which was to say, and you know, some of the jurors have disclosed that they have dealt with addiction in their families. I think today it would be pretty rare to find someone who has not dealt with addiction in their family in some way. And so one of the things that the prosecution said in the opening that I thought was effective was to say, addiction is not a crime and Mr. Biden has not been charged because of his addiction, but it is a crime to lie when purchasing a firearm. So I thought that that was an important distinction to make because I think they were previewing that there is going to be an awful lot of testimony about addiction, you know, text messages, and it really is necessary to prove the case, to prove that he was using drugs or addicted to drugs at the time. And I think I might disagree here with Jill a little bit about the strength of the charges. I think that, you know, the defense attorney has certainly made this the issue. You know, you can't really rebut the fact that he bought this gun, that he filled out this form, that he had the gun, that it got thrown away. And so, you know, the issue that is always most difficult in a case is to prove someone's intent and what was in someone's mind, because we can't read the minds of other people. And although I think the defense has done a good job of eliciting from the witnesses that they did not see Hunter Biden on the day or time that he was filling out this form, there's certainly plenty of circumstantial evidence about the fact that he was addicted in this time frame, that he was using in this time frame. You know, they've played excerpts of his own voice narrating his book about his addiction and his use of drugs. There was a powder residue in the bag that the gun was found in. So I agree it's not a slam dunk, but I think the prosecution has put forward a strong enough case from which a jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And then as to this issue about would he be charged if he were not Hunter Biden, and I think probably not, because I think it probably would have been the case that, like many cases like this, it evades the detection of government officials. You know, government officials don't have the resources to prosecute every case that's out there. And government officials don't find out about every case that's out there. And so this charge is filed. It's only like 3% of all cases filed, this charge of lying about drug addiction to buy a gun. But I think in light of the fact that he was posing a danger to himself with this gun, I know one of the witnesses testified that she was concerned he was suicidal. I don't know that it is a grave injustice to file these charges. I agree that I don't think it would have been discovered if there weren't a special counsel looking into his Burisma connections. But once they found it, they had to make a choice about whether to decline to prosecute or go forward. And, I think in many cases like this are declined because the person is not necessarily a danger to the community. But I don't think that this is a nakedly political decision.
So, Joyce, both on the point that we brought up on the sensitivity when you have family members who are involved in a situation like addiction, and also the government making its case, after the prosecution ended, the defense did call a witness, Hunter Biden's daughter, Naomi, who testified tearfully. And it was after her testimony, actually, that the defense said, you know what, we're not going to call any other witnesses and we'll decide whether we call Hunter. There were other witnesses that were scheduled to testify on Friday. But in part because Naomi testified about how difficult it was dealing with the addiction of her father, his stints in rehab. And she also talked about how she didn't see any paraphernalia in the car, but that sort of contradicted or did not rebut, rather, testimony by Hunter Biden's ex-wife that she did see that paraphernalia afterwards, closer to the time frame where he purchased the gun. So there is concern that maybe perhaps that defense testimony backfired a bit. At any rate, we could get this verdict very soon once we'd know whether Hunter will testify himself or not. Any guesses of what it will be? I mean, this is a tough case. It's an unusual one, as we talked about. It's an emotional one. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And it's worth to answer that question, to think about the role that Naomi Biden was supposed to play. She's 30. She's an Ivy League educated lawyer in private practice in Washington. She acknowledged on the witness stand that she was nervous. And I have the same feeling that Barb has in many ways as a prosecutor. You know, this was a decision by the defense to put Hunter Biden's oldest daughter on the witness stand. As a prosecutor, you would sometimes pass on putting a family member in that position. Here, I think the defense thought they had to do it to create reasonable doubt. And from folks inside of the courtroom, I talked to some friends who were watching the trial this afternoon. It sounds like it really backfired. And where it backfired was when she did not have a good recollection of what happened during a time when her dad was in New York. They were swapping out cars. And she just didn't remember that it had been hard to get in touch with him. They showed her to refresh her recollection. This won't go into evidence, but text messages between the two talking about, you know, dad, where are you? Dad, I'm upset that I'm not getting to see you. And then there's a message from Hunter Biden at 2 a.m. asking if they can swap the cars out in Times Square. So it does look pretty contrary to the reasonable doubt that the defense had hoped to create. I mean, I think, Kim, to the point of your question, I don't think that we'll see an outright acquittal in this case. Whether I would have indicted this case or not, I probably wouldn't. I thought that pretrial diversion, the plea deal that blew up, was a pretty good resolution of it. So many people who are users in possession don't get indicted, and it seems important to reserve the primary statute used in this case for those more dangerous cases, as Barb pointed out. I think the real question is, are there one or two jurors who just won't vote to convict? Sort of the same thing that we considered in the Trump trial, because I think the real issue here is, what is the government going to do if it's a hung jury? Are they going to try this case a second time? You know, this sort of very tenuously hung to the charge of federal prosecutors that you should only try cases that advance the national interest for some reason or another. I think that's going to be a very difficult decision, complicated by the fact that this is a special counsel who sort of makes his own decisions, but still has to answer to the Deputy Attorney General.
Well, let me ask this. I hate the question that I'm asked all the time. How do you think this case will affect the presidential race? So I'm going to ask a different question. You can answer that one if you want to, but I'm more concerned about, with the current right-wing attacks on the judiciary and courts as an institution, how do you think this case, and it, you know, let's take Joyce's prediction that we end up with a mistrial. How do you think it will, what effect do you think it will have on those attacks on our institutions?
Well, just to be clear, I'm not sure I'm predicting a mistrial. I mean, if I was a juror based on this evidence, I think I would convict. Mm. But anyhow, there's a possibility of a mistrial. So
no.
I think we should play your game anyhow, because it's interesting.
Well, what do you guys, or regardless of the outcome, how do you think it will affect the fact that the right wing is saying that the federal system is rigged against Trump when you have, you know, in addition to two elected members of Congress indicted right now, you also have this trial with Hunter Biden?
Well, obviously it's had no effect on the accusation that the system is rigged against Donald Trump. You have three Democrats being tried at the same time, and it's not getting through to Trump supporters. And that's a shame, because it does show how fair the system is, that the prosecutors follow the law and the facts to wherever they lead. And in this case, you have Menendez on trial right now. You have Hunter Biden on trial, and you have another member of Congress about to go on trial. So I think that it has had no impact.
I don't know. You know, if Hunter Biden is convicted, I think it does provide a rebuttal that the system is rigged. I don't know whether the far-right extremists who don't really care about the facts will care or notice or comment. I think they'll just use it to smear Joe Biden, that, you know, guilt by association or something like that. But I thought one thing that was very important to upholding the rule of law is that Joe Biden has pronounced that he will not pardon Hunter Biden if he is convicted. And that is interesting, because any other president might consider pardoning him under these circumstances. But, you know, bad luck that your dad's the president. He's not doing it. So I thought that was a useful statement, because I think it does tend to rebut this idea that powerful people who are in the Democratic Party have this, you know, double standard. I think if he is acquitted and or there is a mistrial, I am sure we will hear more of this disinformation about how, there you go, it just shows the double standard. Trump gets convicted and Hunter takes a walk. But of course, the reality is that every case is different. Every case involves a different set of jurors. And every case has different facts and different law that applies based on the offenses. So I'm sure we're going to hear noise either way.
Yeah, I think Barb's comment is really interesting. You know, Hunter Biden would be more likely to get a pardon if his dad was not the president of the United States, which is a good point that can be made here. But the reality is people who want to believe that the judiciary is not legitimate, that it too has been politicized against Donald Trump and conservatives, they're going to believe it no matter what. There's no way to dissuade them.
This week brought news of a victory for opponents of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. First, a little background on the program and on this lawsuit. So, Jill, let me ask you, there is a fund known as the Fearless Fund. And tell us about what is the Fearless Fund and who's the plaintiff that has challenged its legality.
It's very interesting. Fearless Fund is a venture capital fund, which means they raise money to give early funding to entrepreneurs in the hopes that the entrepreneur will be successful and that they'll own a part of it and make a profit from it. They also have a foundation, a charitable foundation attached to the fund. And that has a program to make an award in a contest to up-and-coming entrepreneurs. And it's limited to people applying who are Black female entrepreneurs. And the lawsuit is brought by the very same person who brought the suit challenging affirmative action in colleges and who succeeded in killing those programs. He's obviously, his name is Bloom, and he is against DEI in general and has used this. And he's relying in this case on a Civil War era law, civil rights law, that was intended to open contracting to Black borrowers and not to hurt the award of special grants. And I mean, just think about all the charities that might be affected by this, who have a program that limits the application process to the people they want to help, whether it's poor people or jailed inmates. Anything that could be linked to race would be eliminated from those programs. And so that's what's at issue here.
Yeah. And so, Joyce, what did the court decide in this case?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. We have to get the procedure right to understand this decision. We've talked a lot about other cases where the merits, the actual decision about the issue is not what's in front of the court when we read an opinion, but there's a request for an injunction, a request to either keep something from happening or to make it happen while the litigation on the merits is underway. And we saw that, for instance, with the Mifepristone case, where we talked about it a lot. Most of the opinions that we read involved that sort of an injunction request while litigation was underway. So that's where we are in this case. What happened is that a panel of 11th Circuit judges was asked to consider the district court's decision that it would not grant a preliminary injunction that would block the Fearless Fund from awarding grant money while the litigation proceeded. And the panel found two to one that Fearless did not have a good chance of success on the merits. That's what you have to find in order to get an injunction, because the grant is substantially likely to violate the federal ban on racial discrimination in legal contracts that's prohibited under Section 1981 of the Civil Rights Act, sort of standing that law on its head. You know, the venture fund argued that its grant contest isn't a contract that's covered by that law, but rather that it's an act of charitable giving that's protected by the First Amendment as expressive speech. And the panel, the 2-1 split, just said no way. Interesting to note, by the way, that the one judge who was in the minority would have found that there was no standing. Oh, where have we seen that before?
Oh, man,
Mifepristone, yeah. Right? Robin Rosenbaum, a judge in Florida, found that the plaintiffs had manufactured a standing, that they didn't really want to apply for any of these grants. So we'll see if that standing argument gets traction elsewhere. The case has been remanded back down to the lower case for additional proceedings.
Yeah, this is really interesting. The Fearless Fund is based out of Atlanta. And so the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is the one that covers Georgia, Florida, and Joyce's home state of Alabama. Very interesting that this strikes me as a sign that we may be seeing more of these challenges to diversity, equity, inclusion programs. And Kim, I'm curious what you see as the implication of this case on larger efforts to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. I mean, at the University of Michigan, where I teach, it is part of our mission to advance diversity, equity, and inclusion. But, you know, after the success of the affirmative action cases at Harvard and North Carolina, we, you know, heard that, corporate programs and minority grants and grants to women are next in the business community. What do you think this bodes for the world of DEI?
Well, it's clear that Ed Blum and his efforts to make America white again are not going to stop at affirmative action. It's also worth noting that the affirmative action case that he was behind, this guy, white male who already has his degrees, that case, they find the standing issue interesting because if you recall at Harvard, there were no actual Asian students. The claim was that the Harvard admissions program disadvantaged Asian students and discriminated against them. There were no actual Asian students who joined this suit. It was just his group that he made up whole cloth to challenge this affirmative action policy because he knew that there were 5 votes on the Supreme Court to end affirmative action. But now he is going after private folks who want to give venture capital money to funders, something that is behind the vast majority of the Fortune 500, 100, all of the fortunes in this nation. You know, I wrote a series a couple years ago about the racial wealth gap, and I pulled up one of the pieces that talk about VCs and says, you know, of the 69 trillion, and this is in 2022 numbers, $69 trillion in wealth that is professionally managed in the United States and things like VCs, 98.7% is managed by firms owned by white men. That's right. Firms owned by women and by people of color get only 1.3% of that pie to control in making decisions about who gets this money. So you tell me about who is being discriminated against in this space. We also know that courts have held that corporations are people with First Amendment rights to spend their money as they wish. Yes. But somehow these black women are not allowed to spend their money as they wish if they're trying to help other black women. So we see clearly what's happening here. We see the turning on its head of civil rights and Reconstruction era laws that were meant to open the doors to society and business and politics and voting and other things to black people being used to literally close it on their face, whether it's voting rights, whether it's affirmative action, or whether it's how the very tiny number, these women who are making this fund are just so the exception to the exception to the exception that even their hands are being tied in the courts by Ed Blum.
Yeah, I want to ask you all about this divide that we see in the law when it comes to DEI programs, because people are very passionate about this issue. Many people want to advance DEI. As I said, it's part of the mission of my university. And others, you know, think of it as reverse discrimination. Or there's a euphemism that Governor DeSantis has in Florida. He calls it like discrimination. He's got some acronym for what DEI stands for, you know, something in indoctrination or something like that. He is violently opposed. Chief Justice John Roberts is one of the justices who repeatedly says that the Constitution is colorblind. And he has written that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. I think he would call that a tautology. Remember that? We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, using a phrase to describe the phrase itself. We learned that earlier this year when he scolded someone else for using a tautology. But I digress. I'm curious how each of you might respond to this argument that the Constitution is colorblind or, you know, I suppose gender blind. I happen to disagree based on Supreme Court precedent. And I have some thoughts on it, but I'm curious to hear how you might respond to that argument. If you were in a room with Chief Justice Roberts and he said, the Constitution is colorblind, how would you respond to that statement?
The history and tradition of our legal practice suggests otherwise, Your Honor.
Nice. That's a good one.
Yeah, I would point out not only since the Constitution in its original form and even in its various iterations was made to empower white male landowners, mm-hmm. yep. that you cannot make a originalist argument that the Constitution is colorblind. But even if you could, you can't, but even if you could, our society is not colorblind. And it is absolutely unreasonable to take a colorblind approach to jurisprudence when the discrimination is staring you in the face in real life. You can choose to be blind to it, as the Chief Justice seems to be, but that doesn't make it not there.
And if it were colorblind, we wouldn't need some of the amendments that we have that give the right to vote, for example, to a class based on color that was previously denied the right to vote. And you wouldn't have needed the 1866 contract law that was just relied on in this case against Fearless, because it was intended to open the doors to contracting for Black business people, or Black people in general. And so, of course, it's not colorblind. It can't be. And as Kim just said, society is not colorblind. And in order to rectify that and to give equality, we need to recognize that color has played a role in our history, and that to rectify it. And, you know, we lost some of that when the court decided that states that used to have to get permission before changing their voting rights laws didn't have to anymore, because we're past that. We are not past that. And of course, the response to holding them not accountable under Title II is exactly what we would have expected. The states that previously discriminated are doing it again.
Yeah, you know, the comments by Chief Justice Roberts remind me of an experience I had when I was working in a law firm. We were having some sort of diversity training in the law firm. And so I was in a room with a lot of people in my firm, good people. I enjoyed working with these people, majority white, majority male. People worked hard to make it a nice environment. I liked all the people there. But the facilitator asked a question along the lines of, how many of you have ever seen or experienced any sort of sexism or heard a sexist comment in any way while working at this firm? And none of the men raised their hand, and every woman raised her hand. So I thought that was interesting. And then they asked a similar question, which was, how many of you have ever experienced or heard a comment that you might consider racist or racially insensitive in any way? And again, I was now in the white group. I raised my hand, never. And all the people of color raised their hand. You know, every one of them had. And I think it is such an interesting thing that you don't experience it if you're not part of that group. Or if you do, maybe you don't perceive it or you miss it. So I think it is super interesting.
And I'm sure this is not the case with you, Barb, but if you didn't hear it, you were the one saying it.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Or you were, you know, blind to it. Yeah. But this issue of colorblind is, to me, legally incorrect. And it goes back to this idea that people sometimes read the text of the Constitution literally, and they believe it is absolute. But even the most conservative members of the court will agree that we have this judicial analysis we refer to as strict scrutiny. And that is, when there is a compelling governmental reason, it is possible to have limits that might be based on decisions that favor one race or another, or favor one gender over another. And if there is some race-based classification, it is permissible as long as there is a compelling governmental reason, and that governmental reason is narrowly tailored to achieve that reason. That is part of Supreme Court jurisprudence for decades. It is what permitted the Supreme Court to uphold affirmative action until very recently. And so this idea that it's colorblind, I think ignores decades of Supreme Court precedent. And so, you know, the idea that we want to make our society better by recognizing that there is racial discrimination in our country or gender discrimination in our country. We want to do the things that, Kim, you talked about, making sure that everybody has access to the full rights, privileges, and enjoyments of being a citizen in this country. And to fail to recognize that, I think, is an effort to lock in the country we were at the time of the Civil War. I know I'm on a soapbox here, but I want to say one more thing. I also, this is something I've heard people say, which is, I personally have never discriminated against a fill-in-the-blank woman, person of color, African-American. I have nothing to do with the fact that many generations ago, some people who were slave owners, held as slaves, people who are Black, but none of those people are alive today. My ancestors were in, you know, some other country. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever. Yes, but we continue to live in a society where there is white privilege or male privilege, and people take advantage of that and reap the benefits of that, which is why we see the statistics that Kim just read to us. And so if we want to have a society that is truly inclusive and has diversity and has members of the public thriving at various levels, then we must have these programs. And these programs are perfectly lawful under the Constitution as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court.
Woo, preach, sister.
Well, we've just had a discussion of three really interesting topics, but now we're getting to the part of the show that we all really, really love, and that is answering your questions. If you have a question for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us at sistersinlaw.podcast on Threads or tweet using hashtag sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question today during the show, keep an eye on our feeds throughout the week where we often answer many of the other questions that you've asked. Barb, the first question comes to you from Terry. What is ex parte conversation? If Cannon is involved in ex parte conversations with Trump's people, can she be removed from the bench?
Interesting question. So ex parte means, it's a Latin term that literally means out of the party. And so what it means in law is that I've had a conversation with one side, but not the other. And that is forbidden for judges. If there is a case and the judge wants to talk to one party, then the other party must be present. Same with regard to a party. They can't just, you know, call the judge and have a chat. If they want to have a hearing or even a phone conference or file something in writing with the court, the other side needs to be part of that conversation. And so the question is, if she were to have ex parte conversations with Trump's people, and I don't think there's any evidence that that has happened, but if she or any other judge did that, could she be removed from the bench? Well, it would be certainly something for which she could face discipline. And so what the precise discipline for that would be would probably depend on the situation and the incident itself. I doubt it would be enough to remove her from the bench. To remove someone from the bench requires impeachment. I think you would have to show that there was some sort of deliberate misconduct going on. I think more often what would happen would be some sort of reprimand, perhaps a reassignment of the case could be a sanction against someone like that. I think it would have to be quite egregious and, you know, some sort of effort to obstruct justice for someone to actually be impeached and then convicted and removed from the bench for an ex parte communication to rise to that level.
Let's not get this ex parte started.
I see what you did there.
We have another question from Canada, from Pierre and Lynn in Blue Rocks, Canada. And Kim, I'm going to give you this question. Why does Jack Smith not indict Ginni Thomas? One would imagine it would trigger Justice Thomas to have to recuse himself from January 6th matters. There certainly seems to be an abundance of evidence to indict, if not convict. Would this not be an effective strategy?
So a couple of things. There are a lot of people who were even more central to the plot as we know it, as has been alleged not only in federal court, but also in state courts, to overturn the results of the election than Ginni Thomas, who have not been charged. Remember all of the unindicted co-conspirators that we've talked about in the Jack Smith case. And the idea is that he wanted to focus on the trial against Donald Trump first. Maybe these people might be cooperating. They may be witnesses. I know Ginni Thomas was questioned. But every other prosecution takes time, energy, and resources against the prosecution of the person at the top of the scheme, who is Donald Trump, and that he made a decision to do that. But to the point of your question, I think the fact that Ginni Thomas is at the very least a witness in the case is enough. You don't need her to be indicted. The fact that she's a witness is enough for Justice Thomas to have never taken part in anything involving this or other January 6 cases. But as we know, Justice Thomas goes by his own rules.
I just want to add to that. The question includes the sentence about abundance of evidence to indict, if not convict. And I just want to point out that as a prosecutor, I would never indict if I didn't think I could convict. And I bet that Barb and Joyce would agree with that.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on now to a question for Joyce. Joyce, a question from Birmingham, Alabama. So, of course, it has to be for you. It's from Joanne. If the public has a right to a speedy trial regarding Donald Trump's many indictments, can a group of citizens sue Judge Cannon for a violation of their rights?
Hi, Joanne. Thanks for the question. And I'm afraid that the short answer is no. Private citizens can't sue here. The leading Supreme Court case on Speedy Trial Act, Barker versus Wingo, addresses this sort of. It says society has a particular interest in bringing swift prosecutions, and society's representatives are the ones who should protect that interest. And so Jack Smith actually tried to do that. You'll recall that he referenced the principle when he asked the United States Supreme Court to directly hear the appeal on presidential immunity without going to the Court of Appeals first, the normal procedure that's followed for an appeal. And part of it was, you know, the public has some skin in this game too. But the Supreme Court didn't bite on that. No court has really bitten on that, at least in the Trump cases so far. And I think that if a group of private citizens were to try to file something seeking to enforce that, it would simply be dismissed, saying that there's no sort of a private right of action in this area.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Jill Wine Banks. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, Factor, OneSkin, Osea Malibu, and Aura Frames. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review because that really helps others to find the show. See you next week with another episode, Hashtag Sisters-in-Law.
They look spoiled.
Yeah. Tell me about spoiled
dogs. Would that be a surprise?
I say that as a woman who shamelessly ordered Shake Shack for lunch today, not because I wanted Shake Shack, but because my doggies needed burgers for lunch. It had been too long.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
oh my God. Snickers, I mean, she would totally move in with you, Joyce.
I'm shameless in getting the dogs to like me. You know, it's just they like the food. And the best of all was we had a chicken who came all the way up our back stairs to get a French fry.
Oh, my God. But I'm the one who gives Snickers most of her treats. You know, I spend most of the time playing with her, cuddling her, all that. And she loves Greg like 100 times more than she loves me. Like, I can't even bribe her love.
Bob gives them breakfast. So they love Bob. They sleep with Bob because, you know, he'll give them breakfast.
Kim, I bet your husband's secretly slipping him a pork chop every night.
Michael gives him the food off his plate. I yell at him every time he does that. Brisby sits next to him every night at dinner, drooling, ruining the floor. It's disgusting. But Michael will not stop doing it. And he'll take food off my plate to give to Brisby.
All right, that's insulting.
I just didn't know that wasn't done. I mean, we always have dogs at the dinner table.
Oh, my God.
But they don't drool. No drool.
Yeah. Well, I'll take
a picture.
Well, I
guess I'm out from your dinner table then, Joy.
If you're drooling at my dinner table, you're a no-no.